Okay, any other questions before we launch into things? There is a homework online, so you can see that. It's due February 6th. So I want to talk today about things you can see. I'm going to try to go through this section of the course faster than I have in the past because we want to talk about dark matter. But there's a lot you need to know about what we can see in order to sort that out from what you can't see. And so it's necessary to talk about these things. So last time we talked about the interstellar medium, 1 centimeter line, CO, tracers of gas in the interstellar medium. And we'll go on and talk about the velocity fields that you can derive from that. So that's one of the big indicators of dark matter in spiral galaxies, where you can see these interstellar medium lines. Then talk some about stellar populations. There will be more in the notes that I will talk about here. Like I said, I don't want to belabor this point, but you do need to understand the stars to know what's not stars. Certainly in the early days of the missing mass problem, one could imagine that simply one had gotten the mass to light ratio of the star's wall. That's all there was to it. And then if time allows, we'll go back to galactic kinematics, or at least individual stars. So, this thing. Okay, so we can observe these interstellar medium lines, that is, emission lines from gas in the interstellar medium. In this case, a 21 centimeter line of atomic hydrogen is illustrated. And what one observes is a blob of emission in a three-dimensional data cube. So one goes to an array of radio telescopes, something like the Very Large Array, where you have radio telescopes laid out in some pattern. As the Earth turns, that fills out a portion of the equivalent large aperture radio telescope, and so you get much higher resolution than you could from any one of those things. And in that fashion, you can build up an image. But in addition to position on the sky, like you just get a projected image of in the optical, you're also measuring the frequency. So for three, you get a third dimension, which is frequency of the line, or equivalently, its velocity relative to the lab frame. So this bluish blob here is supposed to represent the galaxy as observed in that three-dimensional cube. One can then project it out to something our brains cope with better. So this is an image of the galaxy, and it is basically integrated over all velocities, so that all you're seeing is the image as projected on the sky. Add up all the 21 centimeter flux projected on the sky, get some nice spiral there, and that's the moment zero map. It's the terminology. You don't need to know that unless you run into it in the literature. Basically, you can make moments of this map. The zero projection is just the flux. So that's what we would consider the image of a galaxy if we were just talking about stars. Except in this case, it's an image of the atomic gas. And you can see spiral features in this galaxy. You can see holes in the distribution, shells blown by stellar winds, maybe supernovae, concentrations where star formation going on, all that sort of thing. Another projection is not to integrate over velocity, but to project the flux at the same velocities into a velocity field. So now you get what's called moment one, or the velocity field that tells you how the velocities change from one side to the other. So this side is more redshifted. That side, that is to say, this side is coming at us, so it's blue shifted, relative to the center of the whole galaxy expansion, to the Hubble expansion. But from that point, it's rotating around its center. One side's coming towards us, one side's going away. And you can make higher order maps. The second moment is the velocity dispersion, right? So that's the sort of the mean velocity at this point. What is the variation around that? Higher order, how skewed is that? Right? Is it symmetric velocity dispersion or is it more tipped to one side or the other? As you might imagine, as you ask for higher and higher order maps of the data, things continue to get rattier and rattier. So it's only really good data that you can start to ask for moments three and four and things like that. But this is all we need to get the rotation curve, and there's a whole wealth of technology for how to do that. People argue that the best way is, there is no unique best way. It takes a human brain supervise. That's going to be a huge problem challenge for upcoming large surveys, which are going to get thousands of galaxies like this. It'll be great to have all that data. Processing is going to be a challenge. I'm sure people can write software to do it. Whether or not it'll give you the right answer is to be determined. So here's the moment zero from a big survey called Things from a decade ago. This is still the sort of gold standard for 21 centimeter data. And it has two or three dozen galaxies. It's hard work, it takes a lot of telescope time, it's a lot of process. Whereas we're used to thousands of galaxies and slow, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, dozens are a lot for this thing. And that's going to change in the near future. With some large surveys currently underway, and even more so when this square kilometer array gets built, presuming that happens. But this is what we got right now. This is a relatively bright NH1 nearby galaxy, GC2403. That's the moment zero map. You can see all this structure, spiral arms, shells, all sorts of nifty things. And this is the moment one map, from which we derive the rotation curve. And notice there's really one on each side, right? You can see one on the blue shifted side, one on the red shifted side. And if the galaxy is perfectly symmetric, then this will be exactly the same as that. You can tell by inspection it's not. Right. So that's generically true. No galaxy is perfectly symmetric. And that's just telling you there's a little bit of non-circular motion. Throughout this course, the ideal thing we would like to have is a test particle on a circular orbit with which we can trace the gravitational potential whatever object we're curious about. Here you have gas on orbits that are close to circular, but not perfectly. There are spiral arms. There can be systematic flows along spiral arms, gradient shear, all sorts of things. So that not being realized, you see reflected in that asymmetry from side to side and other things. It's a mild effect, but something to bear in mind. What's not a mild effect is that the rotation curve becomes flat, even way out beyond where it is plot. That purplish stuff in there, that's where the stars are. So the stars pretty much taper off there, the atomic gas goes out there, and the rotation curve is showing Keplerian behavior, hence the inference of dark matter. And this was historically one of the early cases that demonstrated that rotation curves not only became flat, but they stayed flat way, way, way out beyond where most of the stellar mass was. Here's M33, local group galaxy, for which you can do this really well, in fact, too well. Again, there's sort of too much information. You can see all the holes, shells, and so forth. And there are ways in software to deal with that. But all I want to illustrate here is that there's the kinematic nature axis. Right? That is where you would put the slit of the spectrograph if you just wanted to use an optical telescope to measure this rotation curve. And you can do it that way, but then you're only sampling along the major axis, and you don't know that you've done it right, because usually you set the slit based on an image. If a galaxy is all nicely symmetric and well behaved, then the kinematic major axis will be aligned with the photometric major axis, that is the direction it looks bigger on the sky. Minor axis is just because it's tipped at some inclination. Okay. So that all makes sense, pretty straightforward. But it doesn't have to be that way. In this case, it's reasonably close, so you get the right answer that way. Usually get the right answer that way. You just don't know it because you don't have all this other information, which you can exploit in a way I'll describe in just a moment. There's also minor axis. The kinematic minor axis here is pretty orthogonal. It doesn't have to be. It can be twisted or something. And if there is such a twist, that's a sign of non-circular motion again, as might be caused by a bar. So the orbits from the bar are distorted from circular. But you see roughly equal numbers, parts of the different colors across that. So that's pretty symmetric. There's no strong bar in M33, which is a puzzle going back to the current puzzle now, pointed out by Yun Tai Shin and Jerry Selwood, that if you build a model of this galaxy that fits the rotation curve, the light profile, etc., let that model evolve, it goes bar unstable. Doesn't fall apart the way the old people's Null Striker model did, but it should form a bar, and it ain't there. So why is that? We don't know. That is still a matter of current research. But if there is a bar there, it'll show up as some sort of torquing of the minor axis. It doesn't have to be. That means this is easy to build a rotation curve. Traditionally, the way this is done is to fit a tilted ring model. So this is sort of an illustration of every ring. Basically, you fit ellipses to this image, but you're not just fitting the image, you're also fitting the velocities. And let's consider that. So each ring here corresponds to one of the rings here. And in principle, you can fit for the inclination, position angle, the shape of the ellipse, all those things, independently for each of those rings. In practice, you have to supervise that. There's usually not enough signal to let all those things be free. But in principle, you can do that. And there are cases where that's OK. Now, if you stop and think about it, what this particular illustration shows, the position angle is changing a bit. But more importantly, the inclination is changing, right? So here you have some sort of flat inner disk, and then it warps up and down. So you see warped galaxies on the sky, and that's how the tilted ring, that was my vision for the tilted ring model, is to accommodate that. This is kind of an extreme example, but that's how it feels. If you look at the velocities in any one ring going around an azimuth, if the motion is perfectly circular, then the amplitude of the velocity is going to be constant there, and that's one of the things you're fitting for. If that's the case, then you'll get a perfect sinusoid in azimuth, right? It'll be maximized at the major axis, minimized on the minor axis, and so as you go around and around, you just get a sinusoid.
In the tilted ring model, do all of the rings have to be concentric?
Well, in principle, no. You can let each one be, you can let the center be a fit parameter. And I'll show you an image where that's not the case. But again, usually you would like to believe that's true physically, so often it's imposed as a, okay. And there are now different codes that do this. The early ones, you can just flip on and off as a switch, which things you want to fix. So a standard approach would be to just let everything run free. You'd get a big mess, then you'd say, okay, that's the center of the galaxy. I'll pin it down to that, rerun the code with those fixed, that would help settle down the other parameters. And then you know, for example, the next thing that would often happen is the ellipticity would change a little bit. You say, okay, this is the average ellipticity, let's fix that, and so on. So you sort of iterate into the best bit. More modern things, you just try to build 3D models that account for all that at the same time. But you're always limited by the data flow. Let you do all that, so they did that. But so just, you know, if you just imagine running around one of these rings, you're going to get a sinusoidal pattern, and deviations from a pure sinusoid is what it tells you about deviations from pure circular motion. So here's another velocity field. I show you these because the first time I started looking at these, my head exploded, kind of hard to clock at first. So it's just helpful to see examples. Now I can look at these things and tell you just, okay, this has a fairly slowly rising rotation curve that goes approximately flat, maybe still rising in the last minute. Do that by eye, because I've looked at hundreds of these things. Don't expect to be able to do that until you've done it for years and years, right? But really what you want to do is to fit this velocity field in each ring. And so what you're fitting is this equation. So first off, the whole thing is redshifted, right? That's the Hubble expansion. Don't care about that for purposes here. That's just setting the zero, the center of the galaxy, in redshift space. If you want to do this at high redshift, you do have to worry a bit about the fact that there's a 1 plus z term that comes from that expansion, and that does affect the amplitude from one side to the side. It's something you can correct for easily. It's negligibly small, a small redshift, so just a go by the way sort of thing. All right, so what you're actually measuring is the velocity at each pixel here times the inclination angle. So that's one thing you want to fit. This thing is not round because it's not seen face on. You always view galaxies as some inclination, so that's one of the things you have to work out. The simplest and crudest way to do this is simply to measure the axis ratios. And imagine that it would be circular face on and ask, okay, what angle do I need to project that ellipse to see the axis ratios that I do? That's traditionally what's done with optical images in big surveys where you just have a single dish observation of 21 centimeter or whatever. You get that flux integral with some line width. Got no idea what the inclination of the galaxy is just from those single dish data. So you look at the optical image and compute the axis ratio. You can do that in the H1 as well, but on top of that, you're getting kinematic information, and that gives an extra constraint on the inclination. So basically, in each ring, you're looking for, you know, basically that circular velocity, that sinusoidal variation as you go around in azimuth. So there's that cosine theta term. Theta is the azimuth. And then if that's not perfectly sinusoidal, that's indicative of a non-circular term, which is the orthogonal component of that is the radial velocity. I'm worried about things out of the plane here. And so that has this term, and so you can combine these terms to fit the this variation here. Right. So you can see here a pure sinusoid fits pretty well. There might be a hint of a little extra velocity there, a little pointiness there, but in this case it's pretty good. But you can imagine something that looks like boom, and then that would be indicative of a lot of non-circular motion. We don't like that. It's hard to model. You can do it, but it's easiest just to have tracers of the circular velocity. Okay, so here's a case where the position angle changes. The central position is a little different, hugely different. But in principle, each one of these ellipses can have a different center. If you let those three, even with really good data, sometimes you will see it slosh around a order of a few hundred parsecs. Sort of negative symmetries in the distribution of mass, but not something that's show-stopper. So that's just the shape, best fit shape of the ellipses. Here's the corresponding isovelocity contours. That's the same as those colors, right? So here's the zero velocity contour that is velocities that are same as the central redshift of the system. And you can see in this case, it's not perfectly a straight line. There's just a little bit of a bar light distortion. Very deep in this case. And then you see this wing-like variation as you go up. And that's typical of basically a steeply rising rotation curve. You see a big gradient here from one side to the other. And then it flattens out, maybe even falls a bit. And there are a whole bunch of them. That's real data. This is from a big paper by Albert Bosman in 1981, which is one of the foundational papers of the field of rotation curves, but also of dark matter. It was in the late 70s that Vera Rubin was saying, look, all these rotation curves are flat. She'd gotten of order 100 galaxies by then. Some of them were really extended, but a lot of them descended where the stars did. So very skeptical people said, well, what happens? And it was largely Bosman's work that pushed this out again over and over and over and showed that the rotation curves were flat, way out beyond where you could explain it with just the luminous mass. But you see there's a huge variety of these kinds of morphologies. Rich amount of information there, but it's also a lot of work to extract that. Nowadays there are a variety of software tools. One good one is 3D Barolo. It's a program that builds a model in three dimensions. It's a bit computationally expensive. Couldn't do this 20 years ago because it would just take too much computer resources. But basically, you build a model to match the data cube, and then you can project it out additionally. So here's a sketch, and this was done by Kaylee Parker. I don't know if you remember. So she worked on this for Capstone. And this is the velocity field. This is the H1 moment map. So moment zero, moment one, and this is the model. So. Build a model in 3D Barolo that best matches the 3D characteristics and project out that model, which by construction is cleaner, but you can see how things correspond. And there's a fairly relatively steep rise to this rotation curve. You can see by eye, not super steep, but the model also captures, you know, the whole, so this is the model, this is the real data. You know, it does a pretty good job of doing. So here's the rotation curve that's basically looking at the gradient along the major axis, actually from fitting the whole things, just looking at the projection. It's called a position velocity diagram. So that's the data that is basically just taking a cut along the minor axis, the velocity there, position along the, let's say minor, major axis. So you can basically see the rotation curve just by eye. That's what you would get from a long slit with an optical telescope. And you can see it's reasonably symmetric, but not perfectly. There's that little kink there. It's sort of there, but not saying anything. This is a minor axis cut, so you cut across there. And that's fairly flat, and that shows you there's not a huge amount of circular motion. So that's an easy thing to do to sort of eyeball what to expect. Here it is in model space. It gives this rather sharp thing. So one of the things you have to worry about when actually dealing with these data is that there's a finite resolution, even with many telescopes and an array like the very large array. The beam size tends to be of order 6 arc seconds, 13 arc seconds. Not what you're used to seeing in optical images, which is typically an arc second from the ground or something. try blurring an optical image to 6 arc seconds or 13 arc seconds, your head will explode. It's really ugly. What that low resolution means is that it's hard to resolve these sharp features, basically, where that sharp rise across there. At least you can, if that's what's going on. So the program knows that, and it iterates to try to find the best fit. That's why you have these long orangish and purplish things sticking towards the center. I think it overdid it. You can overdo it. Depends on where the emission is and so forth. But anyway, that's why this is sharper than that. And this is nicer than that, right? So the model's trying to get you the nicest symmetric thing. It's consistent. So there's the rotation curve, goes up from zero, maxes out around 80 for a while, then maybe it drifts up here. That's all from this noise up here, so that's dodgy. You're also fitting these other things. This is the inclination, the position angle. The position angle is pretty stable, but, you know, it waffles around 160, plus or minus a few. So that's the orientation of the ellipse. You can wobble back and forth. The inclination angle also tends to wobble. So these are things one tends to let wobble and then fix. In this case, it's not a huge difference. This is 75. This is 77 and a half. This thing is pretty highly inclined. And sine I, 75, is the same as sine 77.5 at a very good precision. So that's not going to affect the amplitude. It can.
Right.
That does something different than this. But anyway. Okay, so that's the sort of thing we do. Here's another example, just to give examples. This is okay data, but not great. And so the major axis is not quite perpendicular to the minor axis. You can see that by eye. It's less obvious in the model. The model is trying to minimize that kind of thing. But you can see it by eye here. So a little offset velocity from that bob. You can see a very gradual rising rotation curve there, right? It's just a straight line. Maybe it turns over out here. And that means the isovelocity contours are basically just parallel to each other.
Is that yellow band in the V flat graph where V flat's expected to be, like in that range? Like in the.
Oh,
yeah, that one.
This. So it's not an expectation, that's Cayley's measurement. That's what she was trying to get out of these.
Okay.
So she's basically saying, okay, it looks like it flattened out here. That's the average of these points.
Okay, because in the last one, it didn't seem like it really, oh, I guess it kind of reached there.
If you believe these, that's where it is, right?
Okay. But,
and this is a problem. I mean, she's worked for a long time with this because these are tough galaxies to work with. And this is typical of the morphology of the rotation curves of dwarf galaxies. They rise pretty gradually, slowly turn over towards flat, and oftentimes you don't quite get there. So is that the right number? Is that the right number? I don't know. Right? You have to look at these things and judge. Does it keep going up?
No.
So it's tough. It's hard to change these things. But that's the velocity she assigned. And that's why I say you need a human brain to supervise these things. But you can't just rely on the computer. Here, same thing. It's going up very gradually. Well, maybe it flattens out. Maybe it'll keep going up. It's hard to tell. So the dwarfs are tougher to deal with than the bright galaxies like GC-2403 that I showed early on. It just goes straight up and flattens out. Really unambiguous. Okay. So that is sort of an overview of how this is done. So you know, it's a very involved business. There are people who spend their entire careers doing this. There's a community of people who have perfected these things. And a lot of these details are simply unknown. outside of that community. So I at least wanted to share with you an idea of what's done without teaching it in an entire course, you know, using 3D Burrow. So when people say, oh, the rotation curve is, that's the background, and you always got to take that with some grain of salt. It's still astronomy after all. Okay, now to separate out what is dark from what's not, we got to know something about stars and stellar populations. So stellar populations are composed of lots and lots of individual stars. This is the HR diagram from Gaia, which you've probably seen at this point, right? It's a couple of order of magnitude better than the Arcos, which is the previous space satellite that ESA launched to do this kind of work, which was already really impressive when it first appeared. Now it's just amazing. You can see all sorts of features. So here's the main sequence. This is a plot of, you know, how bright stars are against color. The luminosity is now measured with parallaxes from satellite to real geometric distances. Here's the temperature scale up here corresponding to this color range. Here's the absolute luminosity in terms of solar luminosities. So sun lives right in there at one solar luminosity, about 5,800 degrees Kelvin.